Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Julian Chang, your moderator tonight for our extraordinary program called How Do You Do That? In Conversation with David Perry. Tonight's program is part of our platform program that we have been exploring all through the month of August, looking at the many facets of work. Tonight, it is our pleasure to extend a warm welcome to new members to the club. We know you will enjoy your membership here. We hope you come back often. And I'd also like to welcome back our continuing members and remind our current members that you can always go to the website to see what programs are coming up that the LGBT member-led forum has programmed for you, and also the general interest programs that the club has programmed just for you. Some of the special programs that we have coming up in the next quarter are on October 11, Mormons for Marriage Equality, featuring Mitch Main, and on October 28, Truvada, Can a Pill Prevent HIV? Featuring Dr. Robert Grant and Health Commissioner Cecilia Chung. We hope you'll join us for those programs. These are just some of the many upcoming programs that we feature here at the Commonwealth Club of California. You can pick up our publication and see the complete list of programs, or also go onto our website, commonwealthclub.org. There are question cards on your seats that please write your written questions on there. They will be brought up to me, and I will do my best to ask your question of tonight's speaker. And now please turn off your pagers and cell phones or other noise-making devices. We are delighted and honored to have as our guest tonight David Perry, CEO and founder of David Perry & Associates, a connections, communications, and creativity company, a company for the future. David Perry & Associates has represented the mayor's office or the city of San Francisco for logistically challenging and signature events, such as the Olympic torch run in 2008 that came through San Francisco, the Shanghai sister city delegation to the World Expo in 2010, the remaking of the Beta Breakers run for its 100th anniversary, ongoing representation for Fleet Week, and now America's Cup, which has now started in the waters off of San Francisco. David Perry & Associates also represents many private clients, matching them with influencers, thought leaders, government, media, and consumers to create jobs, generate revenues, and increase the profile of not just the companies, but also of the San Francisco Bay Area region. David is a media expert, and if you are joining us on radio or if you are in the room on Twitter or Facebook, the hashtag for tonight is DavidPerrySF. In his spare time, David hosts a local public television show on cable television, and he and his husband Alfredo Casuso live in Noe Valley when they are not at sea and when they are not traveling. Welcome, David Perry.
Thank you.
David, it's our pleasure to welcome you, but so many people have said, how does he do all those things? So let's start from the very beginning. Where did you go to school, and what did you major in?
Well, I when people ask me where I went to school, I know that it's always the assumption you're speaking about college, but I always start with where I started in Richmond, Virginia at St. Paul's Parochial School, and then 4 years, which really greatly influenced my life, which was Benedictine Military Institute, which was a private boys' school run by the Benedictine monks of Belmont Abbey, North Carolina, and the U.S. military. So the discipline we got was unique, to say the least. And I thought briefly about going into the military. I also thought briefly about becoming a monk at Belmont Abbey, but was going through the coming out process. And at that time, certainly in the late 1970s, the U.S. military and the Catholic Church weren't terribly gay-friendly. Not a lot has changed. And so I went to the State University of New York in Fredonia and majored in music and theater with a minor in communications.
And so what were your aspirations when you were a music and theater major at that time?
Well, I think I'm quite sure that the reason I went into music and theater was as a way to come out of the closet and get as far away from Virginia as possible, and the border with Canada seemed like a good idea. Briefly, my aspirations were to work in theater, and I suddenly realized about the latter part of my freshman year, early sophomore year, that I liked being backstage more. I was fascinated by the process of putting on theater. I've always been fascinated with communications because my mother worked for AT&T Telephone for 46 years, starting as a chief operator at age 16. She was actually working the switchboards the night of the original War of the Worlds broadcast back in 1938. And she would tell me that story as a little boy, and I was fascinated by how technology had changed. And I've always been fascinated with communication. So soon into my college career, I realized that I enjoyed behind the house versus on the stage.
What does behind the house mean to you?
Public relations, communications, the people that fly in the scenery, the people who paint the set, the people who publicize it. Basically, 98% of theater is behind the house. And that fascinated me and still does, and also showed me that there is an art as well as a science to communications and stagecraft.
What about the business part of it? The financing and the partners meetings and the investors that are looking for a return on the show.
I'm sure some in the audience will remember that movie from the 1970s, All That Jazz. And I was taken to see that by my voice teacher. And I've seen that movie now a number of times, and the parts that stick with me are watching the producers sit there in the sidelines chewing their nails off, and, of course, the director's going, it's going to be a big hit, and it's wonderful, and then they find out the director has a terminal heart condition, and there's this scene where they're visiting him in the hospital saying, I hope you feel better, and then the next scene is they're interviewing another director. Theater is cutthroat, and I realized that right away. I have a great deal of admiration for my friends and colleagues who are artists and actors. And I'm still in touch with a number who have gone on to great success on stage from my college days. Making money in theater is hard. And I'm not just talking about the people on the stage. I'm talking about the producers that put money into it.
And I'm sure that those probably gave you really great skills, which I want to explore later on when we talk about fundraising. Now, at some point in time, you left the land and you took off to sea.
I did. The greatest adventure of my life, I laughingly referred to it as my official midlife crisis. In late 1997, a very dear friend of mine was going through the death of his lover from AIDS, and both of us were helping take care of him. And in the midst of all of that, which was very emotional, I got a call from a friend, and it was on my voicemail, one of those old-fashioned machines. And it said, this phone call will change your life. And it was my good friend Kirk Frederick, who had gone to work at Crystal Cruises, which is still one of the world's finest cruise lines. So I called him, and he knew that I was a ship nut. My passion is maritime history. And he said, I got a job for you. What are you doing? And I said, well, I actually just a year ago started my own public relations company. What's the gig? He said, it's writing the newspaper on board the Crystal Symphony, which is a ship I knew very well, beautiful ship. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. Where's it going? And I thought if it was going around the Caribbean, that would be kind of tired after a month. He said, it's going around the world. I said, I'm in. And at the time, I had three clients, and I called them all and thought they would be very mad. And all three of them said, we're very jealous. You can't turn this down. If you ever come back, we'll sign you up again. And they did. So in January of 1998, I got on board the Crystal Symphony in Los Angeles, went all the way around the world westward, back to the Panama Canal, came back in November of 98, and soon thereafter met my husband, Alfredo. So it's like that old Liza Minnelli song, you have to go around the world to meet the boy next door. And at that time, we knew that our relationship was special, but I had another six-month contract, which I cut short, and did another 3 months on the ship and went around once more. So it was a great eye-opener, and I guess just so I get a chance to say it here, I always tell people, if you want to travel and your parents or your friends or your colleagues say, oh, I can't afford it, you shouldn't do it, ask me, because I will always say do it. You will always find a way to pay for it. You will always find a way to do it. And I remember when I was on board the ship, I was one of only seven American citizens, U.S. citizens on board the ship. There were 63 nationalities. And I learned that working at sea is the hardest job in the world, and that Americans don't work very hard. You know, we think we work hard, But I'm telling you that every other nationality on that ship worked harder and appreciated the job more than the Americans on board. And if every American could see the poverty of Southeast Asia and India, well, I think we'd have a very different society now.
Now, on cruise ships, the veneer or the presentation is just flawless, especially on crystal ships. Everything is seamless and anticipated beforehand. So it must be like a play that you were talking about. There's just furious stuff going on backstage.
Oh, it's crazy. Backstage or beneath decks on a ship is just more fun than anyone should have and craziness.
And I know that you were really touched by your coworkers. How did you incorporate their lives into this seamless pleasure veneer that was presented to the passengers through your newsletter?
Well, I wrote about them. I was actually very proud. This was pre-email. And officially, I had a very strict template I had to follow with the newsletter. The font size is the right way. You know, certain titles had to be used, certain style. But I realized after about a month, I'm in the middle of the Pacific, and the soonest my boss back on land in Los Angeles is going to see this is by the time I finish the newsletters at the next major port, which is Sydney. That's 60 days from now. They have to FedEx it. The cruise will almost be over by the time he sees what I've done. So, what is it they say? It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. So I started the first ever maritime history column at sea, and I started interviewing the crew. And we would do, in addition to interviews with celebrities, because there were speakers on board and artists who would come on board to entertain the passengers, I would entertain some of the crew and tell their stories. And what I found out was the passengers, especially the very wealthy ones who were affording a world cruise, which is not cheap, they wanted to meet the crew. The number one request from passengers on board a cruise ship is, where's the crew bar? They want to hang out with the crew, which is strictly forbidden. But I thought, well, maybe there's a way that I can build a relationship between the crew and the passengers. And it was an incredible experience.
Did you think you were out by then? Did you think that being a gay man that helped you make connections between people who may have come from disparate backgrounds, or do you think that sometimes people looked at you and said, "Oh, I'm not going to hang out with him"?
I think it's the same anywhere. I mean, there's if you go to Richmond, Virginia now, my hometown, I'm sure there's people that I went to school with that would say, well, I'm not going to talk to someone because they're black or they're Jewish. And I'm sure there were people on board the ship that weren't happy I was gay. I know there were a couple. But it never impacted me. I don't think being out as a gay person makes it easier or gives you any sort of handicap. It didn't on the ship. I was one of very few openly gay people. I do know there was a young man from Serbia who was married and had a kid at home, and became friends with him over the course of the year. And it was clear to me that he was trying to come out and that he had gotten married out of a sense of obligation and now had this child. And that was very painful. And not only was it painful because of his religious upbringing, Orthodox, but on board were a lot of Serbian waiters who were very, let's just say they weren't very pro-gay. So he really lived in a double closet. It was hard to watch. But not for me, it was fine. I was the openly gay officer and kind of gave me a little special badge, I guess. I don't know.
So what did you do when you finally came back to land?
After I picked myself up from being lucky enough to fall in love with my husband, Alfredo Casuso, and have him reciprocate, the one thing that trip gave me more than anything was I realized, wow, you just went around the world. It didn't cost you a dime. They actually paid you to do it. You did something you've always wanted to do, which was write every day and design a newspaper. And you did it all by yourself with no real template for it. It made me more secure. It also made me, and again, I know I've said it, but I'm not being silly, seeing Southeast Asia and how people live and the extreme difference between the rich and the poor, because there is hardly a middle class. It's rich and it's poverty. Made me realize that a lot of the things we take of as quote-unquote good causes in the United States are really just a lot of whining.
Now, how did you start working for the City and County of San Francisco and the mayor's office in particular? How did you fall into that?
Oh, well, Before I went to sea, I moved here in 1980. I came to San Francisco for the first time in 86, loved it. I, at the time, was working in D.C. for the National Endowment for the Arts and spent the next year finding a way to get here. And my dear friend Anthony Turney at the time was the head of business development. I believe that's the title. I could have it wrong. At San Francisco Opera. And I came out for an interview and got the job. And after that, I was headhunted to work at what became Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. I was their first communications director and then communications and marketing director. And people now forget that the corner of 3rd and Mission, which is now the center of Yerba Buena Gardens in 1993, was not a fun place to be. I'd call friends and say, meet me for a drink after work. And they're like, where do you work? I'm like, 3rd and Mission. They're like, I don't think so. So that experience led me to be in contact with the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency because Yerba Buena Gardens and Yerba Buena Center was at the time the largest redevelopment project in San Francisco history and is still the largest cultural complex built from the ground up west of Manhattan. So I would meet the people at the Redevelopment Agency, I'd meet the commissioners, I'd meet people in City Hall, and again, it was like theater. You know, the politicians are the actors. That's not a denigration against politicians, but they're out front. And it's the people behind the scenes that are making things happen. Bureaucrat has become a dirty word. Bureaucrats are what make any city and government work. So I met several incredible people, and during that process, there was trouble going on with the annual Halloween party that had taken place in San Francisco, which used to be kind of an LGBT gay party, and had now started to attract too much drinking and violence, and there was even six people shot. And I remember Alfredo and I were sitting at the breakfast table one morning, and I said, I think we need to do something about this. I think I have an idea. And so I sent a letter to my contacts at City Hall and at San Francisco Travel, which was then the Convention and Visitors Bureau, and, you know, what is it? Be careful what you wish for. They said, great, why don't you come in and tell us what you want to do? I was like, oh, God. And we put together a campaign called Home for Halloween, which is now in its seventh year and has led to an incredible drop in violence in the Castro. And during that campaign, our work came to the attention of the director of special projects at City Hall. And she said, you know, we're doing the running of the Olympic torch next year. I think you might be just the person. And I remember thinking, boy, that's going to be fun. That's going to be easy. And it was not.
Well, just to put it in context, we just finished the London Olympics, which are wildly successful, but the torch was limited to the UK this year. In 2008, the Beijing Olympics had the torch travel throughout the world, including here, and there was a very short time frame from what my memory was for you to organize and line up sponsors and runners for it. How did you do that?
Oh, it was insane. I mean, we were tasked with I've always said that April 8th, 2008, was the most exciting and most stressful day of my professional life. And that was a Wednesday, and on Thursday morning I woke up and I had no voice. And I'm, which my husband would probably say is a miracle. The strain of it. We had 6 months to plan. We met with everyone from the Chinese ambassador to the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, the Beijing Olympic Committee, and, of course, the torch was going to China, which I don't have to explain to this audience, is always controversial. The thing that I would also like to say, because I'm a great believer in the ideals of the Olympics, is the Olympics are always political. And the Olympics have been used as a political statement for, well, 2,000 years. The Greeks used it. Sparta and Athens had kind of a political thing going. So what was surprising was how vehement the opposition was to the torch coming to San Francisco. And our job had three components. One, come up with a theme for the San Francisco run, which we came up with called Sustainable Journey. Alfredo came up with that. Then the second part of our job was to come up with a way to find 80 people to run with the torch. And we talked about it in the office, and the way we came up with was a good old-fashioned essay contest. Tell us in 250 words or less why your life represents a sustainable journey that makes you appropriate to carry the torch. And the third part was the part that I thought would be the easiest, you know, handle media and just deal with press day of. And that became an exercise in crisis communications.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight, our speaker is David Perry. David, since then, you did a great job. The Chinese noticed you. What has been your working relationship been like with China, one of the greatest economic powers that we have to deal with today as Americans?
Sure. Well, two things. I've always said that on my tombstone, I wanted to say, here's David Perry. He tried to learn as much about as many things as possible. I'm absolutely a generalist. I love to learn, and I love to travel, and I had a brief taste of China when I worked aboard ship. And wanted to learn more. And when we worked on the Olympic torch, we came into close contact working with the Chinese consulate here in San Francisco. And, of course, San Francisco is a city with almost 40% Asian population, of that about 30% Chinese. So I thought, well, of course I need to understand this culture. It's in my backyard. And I'd heard so much propaganda about how evil the Chinese were, I was a little suspect too. And what I came to realize were the people working at the Chinese consulate on the Beijing Olympic Committee were the same as all of us. They were answering to a political system like we're answering to a political system, but they were very proud of the Olympics, and they wanted it to go well. And after we finished that project, Alfredo came to me and said, I'd like to study a new language. Alfredo speaks three fluently already, do a little PR for my husband, and is one of those people who's gifted at it, like I'm not. I'm still struggling with English and Spanish. But I said, what languages do you want? He said, it's either Arabic or Chinese. I said, Chinese. I just had this sense, whatever is going on in the world now, in the next few years, as far as economic growth is going to happen in China, and I really enjoyed working with the consulate. So we have friendships that we developed there. We have lunch on a regular basis with staff there. Our work got noticed by the mayor's office. We were invited to join the board of China SF, which is, for all intents and purposes, the China desk in City Hall. It represents San Francisco businesses that want to do business in China and, conversely, Chinese businesses that want to come here. And then we were invited by the San Francisco-Shanghai Sister City Committee, which was celebrating its 30th anniversary in 2010, something a lot of people don't realize. San Francisco's relationship with China is older than the U.S. government's official relationship with China. So this is a very significant relationship. At the time, then-Mayor Feinstein met with the then-mayor of Shanghai, Jiang Zemin, who became president of China, and they had a close personal relationship. So we were hired to do the graphic design and branding for a pavilion at the expo in Shanghai called San Francisco Week, showing the best of San Francisco business and culture. And then also we helped handle media for the trip, which included, for the first time in quite a while, overseas, three San Francisco mayors, former Mayor Jordan, former Mayor Brown, and then Mayor Gavin Newsom.
Can we go back to the torch for just a minute? So I have two questions. One is, how did you successfully handle it? And what was the key thing that you learned about it? Did you burn bridges in order to handle it, or did you build bridges in order to handle it?
Well, that's interesting. I almost said this before, and actually I will tell the story now. Someone who should go nameless, but someone who was working in our office, and we staffed up for that. It was the most amount of people we'd ever had working for us. And this person who was working for us at the time was very, very devoted to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and was also working on the Save Darfur Coalition. And the Save Darfur Coalition actually tried to hire us to do their PR to oppose the running of the Olympic torch. And I called them back, and very cordially I said, I totally respect what you're doing, but I just think you should know that we're representing the running of the Olympic torch. I think you may want to find representation elsewhere, which they appreciated. The staff person, about 3 days before the torch came through, which was, it came on a Wednesday, the run was Wednesday. On Monday, some of you who were in San Francisco at the time may remember, there were some activists who started climbing the Golden Gate Bridge. And I remember Michael in our office came in and said, David, there's monks on the Golden Gate Bridge. I went, what are they doing? He says, they're climbing it. I'm like, those aren't monks. So this was a very well-executed plan. These people climbed the Golden Gate Bridge towers and unfurled an anti-Chinese banner. And I know for a fact that the press office and the mayor's office and myself looked at that. And, of course, we had to issue a response. But behind the scenes, we're like, that's impressive. That was, boy, you're trying to get your message out there. You certainly did it. But I realized at that point we weren't going to get much sleep between then and Wednesday. And between Monday and Wednesday, the route of the torch got changed three times. And the torch runners by this time were calling the staff person of mine whose job was to be their representative, handhold each of the 80 people who were running with the torch. And also the corporate sponsors, who were getting suddenly very nervous. You know, before all the controversy, they were like, we want everyone to know we're doing the computers, we're providing the soft drinks, we're doing all of this. And after that, boy, you couldn't find any of the corporate sponsors. So the staff person came up to me the day before the torch. So this is Tuesday, the day after the Buddhist activists on the bridge. And he said, I can't do this. I don't think I can do this. And I turned to him and I said, our client is not the government of China. Our client is not the U.S. Olympic Committee. Our client is not the Save Darfur Coalition or His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Our client is the city and county of San Francisco and its mayor. And its mayor, Gavin Newsom, has articulated that he fully supports those people who believe the running of the Olympic torch is a symbol of international peace and cooperation, and he has equally acknowledged those people who are exercising their First Amendment right, which exists in this country, to protest the running of that torch. Now, I can hold those two realities as we execute this campaign. And if you cannot, I totally respect that, but you need to tell me right now, because the torch is on the ground in 12 hours, and I don't have time. So if you're going to do it, you need to tell me now, but if you're not, I have no ill feelings, but you need to walk away now. And he stayed. And I took a deep breath, and I remember thinking, I don't know where that came from. But I believed it, and I still do. And then that night at 11:10 at night at my desk, with two representatives from the mayor's office, we got a phone call from Mayor Newsom, and he said, the route is changing, and here's what it is. And then the mayor's staff turned to me and said, okay, the route is changing, and you can't tell anyone until 11 o'clock in the morning. And at this point, the emails are coming in from the international press, which I thought was going to be the easiest part of my job to handle, like a ticker tape. I mean, my voicemail filled up so much that I had to get a special phone that only three people at the mayor's office had the number for. And I was getting calls in the middle of the night from all over the world in different time zones and asking me, they had heard rumors the route was going to change. We heard that there were going to be protests, there was going to be violence. There had been threats against the runners. There had been threats against the city. It was very serious. There were sharpshooters around town. It was as serious a thing as I've ever been involved in. So I had to tell the truth, a lot of which was, I don't know, or I can't say. And in my job, you know, the only thing anyone in my position has is their credibility, and you can't lie. And if I say to you, I can't tell you, and you push me, I say, I can't tell you. So then that morning, expecting what I had been told at 11 o'clock the night before, we heard that the route had changed yet again. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, the torch, everyone saw it on the stage, left and went to an undisclosed location. Alfredo actually got a picture of it in the warehouse before it went on its run. And I thought I knew where it was going, but I didn't. And for 20 minutes, the torch disappeared into the streets of San Francisco. And I remember I looked, and suddenly 17 cameras came at me. And for about 20 minutes, half an hour, I was the voice of the torch. My brother-in-law actually saw my picture on the a Jumbotron at the airport in Jakarta, going, oh, my God. And it was exciting because I realized this is breaking news. The NBC reporter here said to me, this is the most exciting TV story to hit San Francisco in 15 years. So there was a lot of adrenaline, but all kidding aside, what I was very aware of was things that I couldn't say, which was that there had been threats. People's lives were on the line. The pro-Chinese protesters and the anti-Chinese protesters were being kept apart while exercising their First Amendment rights by the courageous work of the men and women of the San Francisco Police Department, for whom I cannot say enough good things. They saved people's lives that day. And at the end of it, to answer your original question, the Chinese were thrilled because every other city the Olympic torch had been in had not been a success. And the Chinese, being a central government, have to answer to Beijing. And if something goes bad, they probably get a posting somewhere not so great. And at the end of the Olympic torch run, no one was hurt. Everyone ran with the torch. The Chinese felt that their symbol had been respected. And you've never seen so many happy Chinese consular corps members in your life. They were hugging us and they were kissing us. And we're like, well, boy, they're going to get good posting after this. So it was a bonding experience.
Closer to home, you also manage Fleet Week, which is also another logistical bombshells, and sometimes it can be.
Pardon the pun.
Pardon the pun. You know, to a casual observer, it seems like it runs with military precision. That opening Marine band kickoff in the Marine hall, it just, you know, it kicks it off and everything just flows from there. Mm-hmm. There's stuff for kids, there's stuff for parents, there's stuff for geeks. Tell me, what is it like to work with the U.S. Navy on Fleet Week?
Well, it's exciting, and I just want to stress that I don't manage, and I'm part of a very large all-volunteer committee, the Fleet Week Committee, under the leadership for the last 3 years of retired General Mike Myatt, a hero of the first Persian Gulf War, and his lieutenant, Louis Leuven. And 3 years ago, Monique Moyer, who's the head of the port, recommended me because she said, David's a ship nut, he loves the military, he's your guy. So it was a great honor for me to be asked, and my job was to disseminate the information about Fleet Week to the media and to the general public. And one of the main messages was to emphasize the new message of Fleet Week. First and foremost, the mission of Fleet Week is to pay tribute to our men and women in uniform. Second, to promote the idea of emergency preparedness. I mean, San Francisco has, I think, a really excuse for calling itself the disaster preparedness capital of the world. And because Fleet Week, or at least the United States, since Fleet Week happens in October, kind of concurrent with the Loma Prieta earthquake, it has now become our emergency preparedness month. So General Myatt had the idea that Fleet Week should be used to promote emergency preparedness and show how in time of a disaster, either natural or otherwise, the military, the forces of our first responders here and the citizenry can work together to make a safer city. So that's been very exciting. And the first year really was like building a ship at sea, to stretch an analogy, because it had never been done before. And one of the things that I was proudest of was we brought our client, the Academy of Art University, to Fleet Week and introduced them, because one of the first things that was expressed as a need was, we've got about 5,000 sailors in town, and we got to move them around all over town. We need some buses. And Alfredo, who always has better ideas than me, he slipped me a note. We were down at 3rd Fleet Headquarters in San Diego, and he says, we have a client that has buses. I was like, yeah, Academy of Art. So the Academy of Art came on and has now been a sponsoring partner for the last 3 years.
You successfully transformed what could have been a divisive thing but with the military in San Francisco into something that's now something of pride. Talking about something of pride in San Francisco, Beta Breakers is such an iconic worldwide thing that we love. As you know, even if we don't run in it, we love watching it, and we love having our friends run it if we're not running it ourselves. How did you change the message of Beta Breakers from almost a really mayhem party to something that was once again a proud, iconic part of San Francisco?
I didn't know you were going to ask about that, but I'm glad you did, because I'm very proud of the work we did with Beta Breakers, and again, we're part of a team. For the last few years, another PR firm in town, Sam Singer & Associates, a firm for whom I have a great deal of respect, has been handling the public relations, dealing with the press of Beta Breakers, which is extensive. People seem to forget here in San Francisco when you see people running naked or in tutus that it actually is a race. And so he's dealing with a lot of sports media. But because of the work that we had done with Home for Halloween and other public safety campaigns, the mayor's office turned to us again and said the 99th running of Beta Breakers was a complete fiasco. It was worse than ever. And next year's the 100th. The eyes of the world are going to be on the San Francisco. We need to clean this up, and we also need to sell the message, which had been the same, by the way. The message for the last 3 years has been the same. No alcohol, no alcohol floats, the race started later, no public urination in public. But for some reason, there seemed to be this perception that the producers of the race were kind of winking and going, yeah, yeah, we know. And they asked me what I would do. And I said, well, I don't usually quote Nancy Reagan, but in this case I will. You just say no. No is no. I mean, the race had become a complete debauch. There were women, especially, who felt threatened, especially towards the end of the race. There were, like, gangs of men, very drunk, behaving in a way that wasn't acceptable in any city, in any part of the day or night. And people felt endangered. And also, I said, we need to remind people that we're not changing the rules. It is against the law in San Francisco to have an alcoholic drink open in public. And then people said, well, you're taking all the fun out of it. You're telling people they can't be naked. I'm like, no, you only have to go to the corner of 18th and Castro to know that it is not against the law to be naked on the streets of San Francisco. So we came up with a tagline that I used a lot, and that was, we are not here to tell you that you can't have too much fun. We're here to tell you that you can wear a tutu. We just don't want you to drink too much. And we put it out there. And the campaign we came up with was, we're serious. And that's the campaign we did again this year for the 101st running, and we'll do again next year for the 102nd. And what we meant by that was the race producers, the mayor's office, the alcohol beverage control officials, and the police department mean it. We're serious. If you're caught with an open container of alcohol, you're going to be cited and pulled out of the race. And if we see a float, which had just become an excuse for rolling bars, we're going to take it out of the race. So did we ever think that we were going to keep everyone from drinking? No, of course not. But just because you don't think you're going to get 100% success doesn't mean you don't start a campaign. People ask me a lot when I do media trainings, what is the most important aspect of a campaign? And I always say, having the campaign. You have to say you're going to do something and then hope you're going to reach the people who most need to get the message. The people that weren't causing a problem, they knew that campaign wasn't aimed at them. So I think the combination of Halloween and Beta Breakers and the New Year's campaign we work on now has gotten us a reputation as the people who want to kill fun, which I think is kind of funny. But I like to think that our campaigns are taken seriously and are really on behalf of a more civilized city.
Well, let's talk about something serious. I know that you raise a lot of money for your clients and for these events because they necessarily need sponsors. And for the community, you also raise a lot of money. How have you raised so much money? And do you think that it's something that you've gotten better at over the years, or is it something that you were just born with?
I mean, officially, I'm not a fundraiser. I mean, there are people who are far more talented at it than I am. So I like to think that I've helped raise money for our nonprofit clients over the years, and certainly a number in the LGBT community. We're working now on the Rainbow Honor Walk, which was an idea that I had 17 years ago for a gay walk of fame in the Castro, which finally looks like it's coming to fruition in the next year and a half. I do remember a fundraiser, Susan Fox, whom I met at the Management Center several years ago, said something to me that I never forgot. Things don't give money to people. People give money to people. You have to ask. I think the person in town that I admire the most for that is Dee Dee Wilsey. I mean, you know, they always say that the scariest thing in the world is not a person coming at you with a gun. It's Dee Dee Wilsey coming at you with her purse because you know she's going to take out her card and ask for you to open her checkbook. She knows how to ask. And I don't know of anyone who's ever given just for the heck of it. It's because someone asked. And I think, like anything, you have to make it personal. You have to say, Julian, this cause is important to me, and this is why I believe in it, and I hope you'll think about it. And then what you want to do, it's like getting media attention. You don't want to tell someone to do something. You want to get it to the point where it's their idea. So maybe I speak to you about something, and then a couple weeks later you think, wow, that's an interesting cause, and it becomes your idea to give.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program features David Perry. Well, money is here in San Francisco this week because America's Cup, the World Series, has started. I'm personally very excited. The AC-24s are in our waters, and the AC-72s are soon to be in our waters. They'll be the equivalent of a 10-story building going by at freeway speeds. You are involved with America's Cup. So for the non-sailors in the room, tell us about what is in store for San Francisco over the next year or so with America's Cup.
Well, I mean, you know, if it has a hull and goes on the water, I mean, I'm in. I'm like, wow. And when I heard that America's Cup was coming, it's the first project that I've worked on that I knew I was going to go for somehow. I was like, I want a piece of this so bad, I can't tell you. And I told everyone that would listen, I said, I'm sure you'll find more talented PR people around, but I can assure you, you will not find a PR person that knows more about maritime issues or knows more about this race or actually knows the difference between an AC-45 and a 72 and a clue and all that stuff than I do. So on New Year's Eve 2010 into 2011, we got a call and we said, wow, it's San Francisco. America's Cup has been awarded to San Francisco. And soon thereafter, I got a call from our contact at City Hall going, this is going to make the Olympic torch look like a walk in the park. I was like, oh, wow. Because it's not just one day, it's a year and a half. What people are in for is an extreme sport. America's Cup has had a reputation for being a rich man's sport, not even a rich woman's sport, specifically a rich white man's sport. And one of the things that our office is working on is to let people know that most people who sail are not rich. There are over 12 yachting and sailing clubs here in San Francisco. It's a center of sailing. Organizations like BATS, BADS, Bay Area Disabled Sailors, down at the South Beach Yacht Club. A lot of people who just have a tiny boat that they take out with their kids or young people on a weekend. I really am working to dispel the notion that sailing is just for rich people. Secondly, we are trying to let people know that the economic benefit to San Francisco of America's Cup is huge. They are still counting on it generating $2 billion in revenue to San Francisco over the next year and a half, and between 800 and 1,000 permanent jobs along the waterfront, and infrastructure improvements. Jefferson Street and Fisherman's Wharf is being expanded. We're probably going to get the E-Line extension for Muni down along the waterfront. And the thing that, of course, I'm excited about is a new cruise ship terminal at Pier 2729, which is going to be the center of America's Cup Village next year. So what you're seeing is great sports. The fastest boats, they go 52 knots. That's over 64 miles an hour. It's like a race car on the water. They're incredibly well-designed. And as you said, the sails of the boats right now that you can see on the bay up through Sunday are 7 stories tall. And all of these boats are identical. Next year, in starting July 4th, 2013, what they call the AC-72s, America's Cup 72s, are going to come out. And the design of those is top secret. Right now, Larry Ellison's team Oracle is building their 72-foot racing yacht at Pier 80, and I can tell you it's easier getting in the CIA than it is getting into there. So I think it's exciting. Obviously, I'm a ship nut, but the real reason I'm excited is because we know that it's difficult to get large-scale projects done, and sometimes you need a catalyst. And I think what we're going to look back on is America's Cup as a catalyst to a lot of important economic development here in the city.
Well, it's also such a globalized sport. I know that there's probably a Kiwi from New Zealand on every team. I happen to know that, you know, we have top American designers on the Kiwi team. Team China has one Chinese sailor. So it is a, you know, it's not at all a nationalistic sport at all.
No, it's not. I mean, they're making a big deal out of saying we're rooting for Team China. I also have to say that I've got, you know, the Artemis team, which is from Sweden, because we've done work with the Swedish consulate, and I'm a great fan of Swedish Consul General Barbro Osher. They're kind of my underdog. I'd love to see them do well. And Team China. But you're right. I mean, basically, it's the national sport of New Zealand. I mean, for some reason at the moment, the best sailors in the world seem to be Kiwis. I don't know why. It just is a fact. So, yes, it is a national sport in that we've got a Chinese team here for the World Series and a UK team and whatnot, an Italian team. But in a sense, it's all the New Zealand team.
So when you talk about the Chinese team or the Swedish team, who are you dealing with? Are you really dealing with the consulates, or are you dealing with the investors in that team?
Well, in my job, actually, I deal very little with the teams. Our job is working with the whole America's Cup event authority management. And the way I describe America's Cup in San Francisco, it's like a pyramid with the sun shining on it. And the top of the pyramid are the boats. They're the races. And that's the excitement. That's what you see. And then one corner of the pyramid is the America's Cup Organizing Committee, which is run by Mark Buell, a well-known philanthropist in town, and Kiri McClellan, the executive director. And their job is to raise over $35 million to pay for it, because that was the deal the city struck. We're not taking it out of the general fund. You got to raise the money. And then the other part of the pyramid is the America's Cup Event Authority, and they're the people that do the marketing and the public relations. And then the sun that shines down on this pyramid is the city and county of San Francisco, and that's our client. So we liaise with all three of those other entities to promote the sport, to promote the economic benefit, and to help diversify the image of America's Cup to make it something that everyone would love. And as someone who believes in it, I hope a lot more people will come to love the sport.
Well, one of the ways I think that's happening is typically San Francisco, which is, you know, America's Cup has its own Facebook page, and a lot of social media and Twitter feeds are like going crazy yesterday when the Italian team Luna Rossa won. How are you using social media and modern communications technology now in what you do?
Well, I mean, I love my iPhone to the point where I had to get this battery here that you see because I keep running out the battery every day because I'm taking videos, I'm taking pictures, I'm tweeting, I'm Facebooking. Social media, I just spoke last night at the Public Relations Society of America on how social media was changing journalism. And one of the things I said was, pretty soon we're going to stop calling it social media. We're just going to call it it's media. You know, we used to differentiate between print and online. Well, everything's online now. It's just media. And we're all journalists now. I mean, if an earthquake hits right now and you dash under your chair and you tweet a message, earthquake, Commonwealth Club, are you an earthquake victim or are you a journalist? I mean, look what happened in Haiti. The people that were talking to us from Haiti wasn't Anderson Cooper. It took him 2 days to get down there in his cute, tight T-shirt. You know, it was earthquake victims talking to us. And, yeah, we laugh at this, but it's a fact. We're all journalists. So social media is, I think, the most important development in journalism in the last 50 years. We all have the potential to influence events. And if you hear that Julian likes a race and you're one of Julian's friends, you're going to listen to that more than maybe someone you hear in the paper. So social media is key to the marketing of America's Cup. It's certainly key to the teams. They all have Facebook page and Twitter feeds. And it's also very important to the quote-unquote legacy media, newspapers, TV, radio stations that follow it. Because as a PR person, they used to come to me and ask me to give them information. Now they go to my Twitter feed or my Facebook page, so I better have it updated all the time.
Well, you still are involved with what looks like old school journalism now or media outlet through your cable show, 10% with David Perry. What was your vision coming up with that show?
Well, I'm very proud to say it's now the longest running LGBT show in Northern California. I would say California, but I think there's someone in Southern California that we have yet to beat, but we're working on it. And 3 years ago, Comcast came to me and asked me if we would develop a show for the LGBT community, and did I have a concept? And I said, yes, Charlie Rose, a person, a desk, a conversation. I mean, wow, how unique. And I guess that sounds old school, but, I mean, we're here talking and having a conversation. I think people still want it. I'm not someone who believes technology is an end. It's a means. It's a means to connect people one-on-one. I really believe that strongly. So the concept was, it's a half-hour show. Unfortunately, it's not an hour like Charlie gets. But it's me and two guests, sometimes one guest, for half an hour. And I was very clear that although it was their LGBT niche show, that doesn't mean that all my guests were going to be openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. I wanted to talk to people and present issues that were of interest to the lesbian and gay community, which sometimes means theater, music, the arts, politics. So by no means are all of my guests gay or lesbian.
How do you choose your guests?
Once a month, I sit down with our producer, Michael McHale, and we go through people. Now people are pitching us. The first month was difficult. First month was a challenge. Now people actually pitch us. We try to keep it topical, so we try to talk about political goings-on. And once a month, we tape 5 shows. So we've now just taped our 156th unique show. We try to achieve parity, half men, half women, transgender community representation included in that. And we broadcast all the way north to Mendocino, all the way down south to Santa Cruz, and I believe it goes as far east as Reno. So it's got a wide reach. And I've been told in the next few months that we're actually going to go down to Los Angeles because there's certainly a lot of people that I think would be interested in being on the show down from Los Angeles.
So being involved with what you do with these highly complex, hugely visible events, how much does politics enter into it, politics with a small p and politics with a big P?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a great believer in being very upfront about who you are. I mean, I'm a registered Democrat. I'm a member of the Democratic Party. I hope President Obama wins re-election. I also have a number of friends who are Republican. and my brother and sister-in-law, to whom I will send this podcast, I assure you, are founding members of the Tea Party movement. So I can assure you we have some lively exchanges on Facebook. One of the things I said yesterday in my talk was, I think that to really understand and use social media effectively, you have to not just like people you like. You have to like people that you don't like on Facebook. That's how you learn. And my first boss, actually my friend Anthony Turney, said to me about my first boss, who was a Republican and close friends with the Reagans, when I was outraged that I was working for a Republican. He said, David, you will find as you get older, you learn more from people with whom you disagree than those with whom you agree. And he was right. So I may be a Democrat, but I am very much an out-front moderate. I believe that the only way to get anything done is to find places where we agree. And I sometimes think, to San Francisco's detriment, the word moderate has become a dirty word. I think it is wrong that sometimes in our political circles in San Francisco, there are no Republicans in the room, and if they are, they're hissed off the stage. That's not right. I think we need to be a society, especially in San Francisco, which is uber liberal and for which I'm grateful. We need to find ways to create dialogue, and I think that's very, very important. That's the big P. The small political thing, I guess, I can explain the same way. I believe in creating relationships. You know, I think anger is like the person who said, I can't think of his name now, but he wrote the book Conversations with God. And he gave one of my favorite quotes to me, which is, anger is fear announced. And so whenever I see someone really angry, I'm like, they're afraid of something. I wonder what they're afraid of. And I think if we go into a situation and learn what people are afraid of, we might be able maybe to make them less afraid, and maybe we'll learn something ourselves.
Okay, let's dish for a minute. Have you ever been scared by one of your clients? I mean, has there been a client so difficult, and don't name names, that you have been scared of them, and how did you handle that?
Oh, gosh. Well, I wouldn't say I was scared of the Olympic torch, but I was aware that we had bitten off a lot. I think the only time I was really frightened was the first Halloween campaign. I was scared. I remember that was one of the only times in my life I actually had to take a sleeping pill to get asleep at night. Because I don't know if people remember it, but 6 years ago there was a lot of opposition to canceling Halloween in the Castro. I mean, I got hate mail. I got personal hate mail that was really quite unpleasant. My name was in the paper. I testified before the Board of Supervisors. I was called out by our opposition. First, because they said the campaign wouldn't work, and then because they said too much money was being spent, and they put in the paper how much money the campaign cost, which was $40,000, which, trust me, is not very much for a six-month campaign. And so then they said, well, you're not spending enough money, so we couldn't win. And everyone said it's not going to work, and we had 250,000 people last Halloween in the Castro, and I was really soft-pedaling it. People said, what would be success for you? And I was like, well, you know, the SFPD have said that anything less than 50,000 would be manageable. And we were on BART. We were handing out flyers. I personally drove to taxi companies south of Market handing out flyers for the campaign. And I was really scared because we knew there was a heavy gang element to the problems in the Castro. And I was really worried that someone was going to come in with a gun on purpose to hurt someone. So Halloween came. And I was my media center was at the Twin Peaks bar, probably because it was a bar there too. No, it was closed that night, but I was nervous. I mean, all kidding aside. And 1,000 people showed up. 1,000. And I was proud of that because I said our message got out. And so then the people who said it wouldn't work kind of shut up. And the people that said that there was going to be violence, they shut up. And the people that said that the gay community would never have a party again, they shut up because the next year the party came again. All we said was we're not going to close the streets and we're serious. We're not going to accept violence coming into our community. I was proud of that. That scared me. That's the only campaign I've ever done that I was really scared. I was scared for the community and I was scared for myself because they'd put my address all over the press. Alfredo wasn't too happy about that either, but...
One of your passions you've mentioned many times is, you know, being at sea. I mean, not only did you work on a cruise ship, but now you go on free cruises as a lecturer. based on your knowledge of maritime history.
I'm really glad you said that, because I think all my friends who share pictures on Facebook go, where did David get this money? I'm like, we don't have it. I travel for free because of my obsession with ships. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, my mother and I watched that old Barbara Stanwyck, Clifton Webb film, Titanic, which is terrible history, but wonderful melodrama. And I was hooked. I just said, wow. And the next year, my mother bought me a copy of Walter Lord's famous book, A Night to Remember, which if anyone is into the Titanic, that's the only book to start with. And at that point, I knew. I said, one day I'm going to work on a ship. It wasn't that I wanted to be a passenger. I didn't want to be John Jacob Astor. I wanted to be Violet Jessop, the woman that worked on the Titanic. And so when that call came, I jumped at it. And during that experience, I met a man by the name of Bill Miller, who is one of the three foremost maritime historians in the world. And he came up to me in 1998 on the World Cruise, and he said two things. One, I want you to write the foreword to my next book, which I did. And he said, two, I'm not getting any younger. You should do this. He was a lecturer. He spends 200 days at sea talking about ships, which would bore most people to absolute boredom. And so I said, well, sure. So I finished working on board the ship, and Alfredo put together a little mini video commercial of me talking about ships, and we sent it out. And lo and behold, someone called back and said, we'd like to book you. And we get a free trip. They fly Alfredo and I to the ship. We get a free cruise. I natter on about old ocean liners, and I come back. It's the greatest thing in the world, I have to admit.
Okay, so in your professional capacity as a ship lecturer, is there any reason to expect a challenge to the 60-year Blue Ribbon record in the future?
Oh, I think I know who asked this question. The answer for those who want to know what the question means is the Blue Ribbon is the name, the award given to the fastest crossing of the Atlantic by ship. And by ship, we mean ocean liner, during the great age of ocean liners. And the last blue ribbon holder for the fastest crossing of the Atlantic in just over 3 days and 10 hours was the SS United States, the greatest ocean liner this country ever built. And it's now in Philadelphia awaiting restoration, and it went officially 38 knots. Many people believe it went as high as 40 knots, which is over 53 miles an hour. So I don't think anyone's ever going to break that record. In the 1970s, there was an experimental catamaran that crossed the Atlantic faster than that, and I just think that's cheating. That's not an ocean liner. So I don't think so.
David, you've built a great brand on who you are through the years, whether it's been writing a newsletter on board ship or dealing with consulates or dealing with people who are peeing in public.
It's all about porta-potties, public safety campaigns. It's all about porta-potties.
In your opinion, how did you establish your reputation? And how would you advise someone who wants to do what you do to create an effective reputation the way you've created one?
Well, I thank you for that. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I guess once you get to 50, people listen to you, because if you don't know what you're talking about, you're supposed to. So I guess that's part of it. You live long enough to do what you do. And I've been doing public relations since I was 23 years old. And as I said earlier, I really do feel strongly about communications as a way to build relationships. So the only thing I would say is I never set out to do this. I never thought I would own a public relations or communications firm. I never crossed my mind. I fell into it. I remember my first job in PR, walking in and seeing a news release that was really badly written on a piano of a theater company, and I said, can I rewrite this? And they said, you can rewrite all of them. And the next thing I know, they'd made me a business card that said PR director. And so I did that for a while. I really feel strongly about the importance of the written word. So I guess if I would like to say what I hope my brand is about, I hope it's about authenticity. I hope it's about honesty. I hope it's about kindness. I think that that's how you build relationships.
And now it's time for our final question. David, how much of success is based on just showing up?
99.9% of it. I remember when my mother passed away in 1979, I had to clean out her desk at AT&T. And as I said, she, along with my grandmother, was my hero. And I remember the advice they gave me. The most important thing is to enjoy your work. And when I opened my mother's desk drawer, I found a little handwritten note, and it said, success is a journey, not a destination. And it sounds like a cliche, and it is, but I'll never forget it. And somewhere in a box, I still have that piece of paper. I think anyone who says they are a success doesn't get it. Success is an ongoing journey. So if I've done something to help my clients, I'm happy about that. My business model probably isn't very smart. I only work with people I like and causes I believe in, and hopefully I'll still be doing that for probably another 20 years.
Our thanks to our guest tonight, David Perry, and also to our audience here. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.